brute force. If it doesn't work, you're just not using enough. You're listening to Softweb Radio, special operations military news, and straight talk with the guys in the community.
Hey, welcome back. This is Rad, and this is another episode of SoftRep Radio. I want to remind you to go check out our book club. It's softrep.com, book-club. You guys know what it is. Go check out the book club. We also have the merch store, where we have branded goods from SoftRep that you guys have been like tagging me on the internet in. Keep that up, and you know, maybe we'll pick someone to win a prize. Keep tagging us. Today's guest is someone special, because he's just a human being on this earth who was tasked with raising his hand to defend his country that he chose to do, and decided to go to college and become an officer in the military. And so I have Colonel Roland J. Tiso Jr., United States Army retired, author. You know, he is going to be, let me go over his background here. Colonel Roland Tiso was commissioned a second lieutenant of infantry upon his graduation from the Virginia Military Institute in 1973. He commanded infantry companies in Korea and the United States, the 1st Battalion, 508th Airborne Infantry in Panama, and United States Task Force Sinai, multinational force and observers in Egypt. He was the chief of War Plans Division, U.S. Central Command in 1996-97, and was one of the primary planners of the Iraq War Plan. He was executive officer to the commander of the U.S. Central Command 1998 to 2000. He is a graduate of the U.S. Army War College, the Command and General Staff College, and the Armed Forces College. The show is over. Holy cow. Welcome to the show, Colonel Roland. Sir, dude.
Sir, thank you very much, Red. I hope you had fun with that.
I had fun with that. You know, I read it like five times before we were going to meet up, and I thought I had it like a breeze. But as I'm reading it, you have quite the resume. And as a young man, let me just hit you right as a young man. You're 16 years old. Are you in like Boy Scouts? Are you swimming? What are you doing at 16, 17 before you go off to high school, college graduation?
Well, that's interesting you should ask that. That particular period between 16 and the time I entered the Army, my principal focus was sports, and I went to school at that time at a place called Pelham Memorial High School in Westchester County in New York. And again, the principal focus was football, wrestling, boxing, believe it or not, and track and field. All of that served me very, very well for a decision that I had made many, many years before, and that was to become a soldier. And so, armed with that, I entered the Army and then the Virginia Military Institute in 1969.
So you enlisted?
Initially, but that was very short-lived, primarily because of my football background. The Army decided that, you know, maybe I could play football for them, but there was no room at the United States Army Preparatory School, so I ended up on a bus to a place that I hold in extremely high esteem. And that was the Virginia Military Institute, and I was commissioned a second lieutenant from there in 1973.
So you're definitely a Vietnam baby.
Yeah, of course, my actions all occurred after the conflict. But my brother served there, and I'm very, very proud of him, very, very proud of my family's legacy with respect to service. My father and his four brothers all served in the Great World War II. They are my heroes, and they were the basis upon my decision very early in life to become a soldier.
That's very powerful. I also joined because of the family. My father, former Green Beret, and I just idolized that. That was my father, you know, my hero, and my grandfather, World War II Navy. My dad also Vietnam Navy. So you just have this legacy. And then to come to find out later in life, after my dad was adopted, didn't find out his dad until he had died. But his dad was in Vietnam the same year he was in Vietnam. And he never knew that. It's like they were just going to pass each other. So there's just this weird legacy. You know, I'm wearing Tiger Stripe right now. I just can't help it. I'm a 70s child. So before I get into the hard hitting stuff with you, when you decided to go infantry, was that because you just wanted to go infantry, or were you pulled out of basic into infantry? I'm curious about that. Is that like a job that you chose?
Well, the, you know, I mentioned my legacy, very, very proud of my father and his brothers. But my father was an infantryman. When he initially went in the Army, he was assigned, believe it or not, to the coastal artillery because he was a phenomenal, mechanically inclined individual. And he became an expert on all weapons from the 16-inchers that we all know from the battleships, but were also the big coastal artillery guns, right down to the small arms of the day, the Garand, the O3, Springfield, the Thompson machine gun. And he could take those things and put them back to take them apart, put them back together again, fix them. He was an amazing man that way. But as the war progressed, he was tired of sitting in Connecticut, where he actually engaged a German submarine off the coast. But that was not enough for him. So he volunteered for the infantry and was decorated for heroism during the Central European campaign in 1944-45. That, I thought, was the standard, along with my uncle Mark, who was very badly wounded fighting with the 29th Infantry Division during the assault on the Siegfried Line. They were my heroes. And I thought, you know what? That's what I want to be. I want to be an infantry officer. And that's what I put all of my efforts toward on the athletic fields and eventually on the drill fields of the Virginia Military Institute.
Now let's flash forward 2001, 9/11. So I remember I was in bed. My dad woke me up. He's like, "Hey, Aaron, wake up, turn the TV on." We were watching the TV of the first tower smoking. Second one got hit. At that moment, he looked at me and he just said, "We're under attack."
Yeah, let me tell you, that was quite an eye-opener. And for me, I had just arrived at United States Central Command the month before, having successfully commanded United States Task Force Sinai. I was very, very proud of having been selected for that assignment, where, by the way, I also served as the chief of staff of the multinational force. Mm-hmm. And of course, I speak about that in the book that I wrote in Strange Company. But I was sitting in my office on 11 September, and I actually had the news on when the first aircraft hit the building. And I thought to myself, oh, my God, what a terrible, terrible accident. And I said that because you may not be aware of this, but in 1945, I believe it was a B-17 bomber on its way back from Europe that had flown into the Empire State Building, a similar kind of event. But then the second plane hit, and I got up from behind my desk, and I walked into my boss's office, and I said, "Sir, something's not right, and I believe we've been attacked." And then, of course, shortly after that, the truth became known. And we started gearing up at United States Central Command to deploy a forward headquarters to Afghanistan. And the rest is history.
And you talk about this history, and you mentioned it in Strange Company. I do want to mention that you've wrote a book, and you're out there talking about this and wanting to let people know about it. And I don't forget about that. You know, I just want folks to know that you started out without really a recruiter coming at you, except for your family wanting to join the military. You had this passion, and I want to reignite that passion with someone who may listen to this, and they may want to join and take that next step. So, you know, we need those Constitution fighters out there.
Well, I think that's particularly important, and especially today. You know, I am very, very concerned about what's going on in today's armed forces. And I believe that some of the policies that we've seen of late have led to a lot of young men, and I say men, we need men in our Army and our Marine Corps and the other services, to look elsewhere, to not want to serve in given what they have seen of late. And it's something that I understand and something that I think will change very shortly. Because let me tell you, Brad, as you well know, you know, the enemy has a vote in how we perform on the battlefield. And right now, I am very, very concerned that the status of readiness of our armed forces, and I'm particularly the Army and the Marine Corps, those ground combat organizations that are manpower intensive, okay, is not up to snuff. I think that far too much time is being placed on nonsensical issues that frankly are driving a lot of our young men, as I indicated previously, to think about doing other things. I believe that will change. I believe that will change perhaps in 2025 when we might be seeing a change in leadership. I don't know. But I'm certainly hopeful of that.
As a colonel, someone who climbed that grade ladder, you know, with all diligence, if some Congress could hold up 300 appointments just because they want to be able to play games with your job, that would make you, with all of this knowledge and all of this schooling and all of this leadership, maybe look to the civilian market versus like, hey, why would I want to work for someone who can just like put their thumb on me when I'm supposed to be the one defending, you know, the oppressed?
Well, I would only say this. I am familiar with the issue that you just raised. And I always viewed that as a temporary situation that certain congressmen engaged in order to perpetrate a positive action on the part of our administration and perhaps our military to do other things that they thought were badly needed. And I'm inclined to think, as I just said, are very badly needed. But having said that, I think that young men today are not going to be overly concerned with that particular issue. Ultimately, the United States Armed Forces have always dealt with our Congress and with civilian leaders, a number of whom, unfortunately, true today, don't know one end of a rifle from the other, and never walked a mile in yours or my shoes, or the shoes of countless other millions who have in fact served this nation. And so to the young folks out there who think otherwise, I am inclined to say, look, you know, in 1961, a man stood up who was a Democratic president, and he said, you know, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. And I think that that holds true not only for the time that he raised that in 1961, but it certainly holds true today. We will continue as senior officers to deal with the Congress, and they will be as irresponsible as they were in 1781 when they were not paying our army and Washington had to do everything he could to keep an army in the field during the Treaty of Paris discussions that eventually ended the war. We've always dealt with these things, Rad, and our nation will ultimately prevail. But we need young men, and we need them now to recognize that they need to serve their country, that freedom isn't free.
Just to keep the country ready. That's right. Just to keep the country ready, you know, we may not even be per se at war, but you have to keep all of the stuff oiled and, you know, running, and the keys got to turn inside the machine so that it can turn on when that action happens. And so, you know, you could totally go talk to a career counselor at a recruiting station and see if they can offer you some type of a technical job, welding, diesel mechanic, you know, all these different things can help you when you go outside of the military sector to civilian world. Like you're doing right now, you went from being really top of the league, top of your game in the military to what am I doing today? You know, I'm out of the military. You know, it's like I've retired. It's like, wait, do I wake up and shuffle up and jump with the guys again? Will they notice me if I go? You know.
Well, I was very fortunate in that regard. I very reluctantly left the Army, mandatorily retired, as you know. Mm-hmm. But interestingly enough, after I was handed a flag by a young soldier and thanked for my service, I walked out to the parking lot to jump into my vehicle, and I was approached by a very fine fellow who had been an intelligence officer and had been my control when I went to Somalia in 1994. He said, "Hey, Roland, how you doing?" He said, "What are you going to do? Understand that you're being made to retire." And I said, "Yes, that's true, and I don't have a clue right now, but I'll figure it out." And he said, "Well, let me help you." It turned out that at that particular juncture in 2004, and 10 years after he had been my control while I was in Somalia, he said he was now a program manager for a defense contractor working at United States Central Command doing intelligence planning. Well, as you know, Rad, I am a planner. Mm-hmm. I'm an operations planner. However, when I pointed that out to him, he looked at me and he said, "Hey, Roland, don't worry about that. Our plan shop desperately needs you. Would you like to have a job?" And I said, "Well, sure."
Sure.
Yeah. So I, for the next 11 years, I worked as an intelligence planner and analyst. And that allowed me the opportunity to continue to work with soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines. And I deployed on 5 more occasions to Afghanistan, one time to Pakistan, and then later as a private defense contractor after I left United States Central Command when our contract ended, I went to Iraq to serve 18 months supporting the Iraqi Air Force. So I was very, very fortunate in the aftermath of my career. And then when I left defense contracting in 2020, I decided a year later to pick up where I had left off. And that was writing a book that I had started, believe it or not, in 2005. I had put it away in 2008 in order to go overseas as a defense contractor. And so in 2021, I picked it back up, and lo and behold, it was it caught the fancy of Casemate Publishers, and it was copyrighted in 2023 and released on the 15th of January of this year. So I've been very, very busy.
I have it right here. It's on my phone. And so it's "In Strange Company, an American Soldier with Multinational Forces in the Middle East and Iraq." And the cover is littered with all of the ISAF, right? Is that what we would say is the security forces, the International Security Assistance Force?
Yes, exactly right. And of course, at the very top of that, of course, is the emblem of which we are most proud, and that is the flag of the United States of America. But flanking it, of course, are two very, very key countries that served in the multinational division Central South, to which I was assigned as a senior advisor, those being the country of Ukraine, which is to the left of our flag, and to the right, the Polish flag. The Poles, of course, I would submit to you, along with Great Britain, one of our staunchest allies. And I was very, very proud to serve with these exceptional soldiers, and very proud. I don't normally say this, Rad, but both of those countries saw fit to have me decorated for the services that I provided, both in combat and on the staff. I'm immensely proud of those decorations, and I am very, very proud of the Ukrainian and Polish people, for not only for what they have done in Iraq, but what they are currently doing. The Poles, of course, in NATO, and and my Ukrainian comrades fighting so gallantly against Putin and his Russia.
And his evilness and his autocracy and all his this is my land and I want the empire. I don't want to get into that. I want to talk to you a little bit about, well, I mean, I do want to get into it. I love your opinion on it. And I think we can agree that I don't want the fight here in the U.S. I was talking to a friend of mine just the other day getting an oil change. This is the same guy. I talked about it before on another show. I said, are we really ready for our Cal Ranch right there just to get blown apart while we're talking? And he just looks at me. I'm not ready for like a missile just to come sailing into us. And I said, that's what's happening over there. Now, either we put effort into them to support them and keep it over there and keep that fight pushed away from our shores, or it's going to be too late here. If we have it here, it's too late. That's my opinion.
Well, I have to agree with you. As a matter of fact, I would submit that America's policy since 1945, when we, during the Cold War, which started, as you know, in 1945, and I suppose technically ended in 1989 with the fall of
the wall
and the dissolution of the Soviet Empire. Mm-hmm. We always had a forces forward strategy, which meant, of course, that we kept a good portion of our army in Central Europe and in Korea. And, of course, we still maintain forces in both of those places, as well as in bases around the world. All of this, of course, is oriented on ensuring that we can respond and to do so very, very quickly, as opposed to having to, one, move a large number of forces from the United States, which takes time, effort, money, goes without saying, but also to battle the evil that confronts us on any given day forward, as opposed to on the shores of the United States of America.
Mm-hmm. Geez, you're great. I know we're not perfect in this life, and I know there's people out there that are probably your critics. And so let's ask some critical questions. Iraq happens, and we send over an ambassador that doesn't speak any Arabic, and he dismantles the Ba'ath Party and fires the army. How do you feel about that?
Oh, well, you know, it's interesting. I discussed this a great deal in Strange Company. As you know, I was available once we redeployed the Peninsula Shield Force, which was the Arab division in Western Kuwait. I was the senior advisor to the Saudi Arabian general that commanded the Peninsula Shield Force. And after we redeployed those forces home, I was available. And they took a look at me and said, you know, we've got just the job for you. And I was flown into Baghdad, and to make a long story short, I was assigned eventually as the C3, that is the operations officer. And because we were so shorthanded, I was the chief of staff of the Coalition Military Assistance Training Team. This command, and it was commanded by a very, very fine Major General, who was a War College classmate of mine by the name of Major General Paul Eaton, was tasked with the development of the new Iraqi army. But I should say that the decision to eliminate the Iraqi army that was standing in the field was contrary to all of the brain trust planning that had occurred between 1994 and 1998. And that planning called for a force that included some 10 divisions of the Iraqi army, which, of course, we would have purged of outright criminals and the like. We would have rearmed them, reoriented them, placed advisors with each of the divisions, and then used that manpower to protect the borders of Iraq to quell any Sunni Shia problems that arose in the aftermath of Saddam Hussein's downfall, and provide us with an opportunity in time to begin withdrawing our own forces as we develop further this 10-division army into something even more credible to be a bulwark, particularly against the enemy to the east. And that, of course, is Iran. Back to the new Iraqi army. Everyone knew that Iraq had to be able to protect itself at some point, so we were told that we would develop an army of 40,000 men that would be lightly armed, would have no heavy weapons, no artillery, no air support, but that now that Saddam was gone, everything would be fine. Well, we started out on that task, but thanks to General Eaton, in large measure, we started to upgun that force. And by 2004, after the new Iraqi army's initial units failed, I suppose is the right word, during its battles in An-Najaf alongside U.S. forces, they didn't do very well. They weren't prepared for that kind of fighting. The decision was made that we would upgun that force. But it took a long time. And the Iraqi army wasn't, I would dare say, a credible force until well into the decade. And as you know, the decision was made to withdraw U.S. Combat forces in large measure by 2011. By that time, a number of the coalition, certainly the forces with which I had served in the Multinational Division Central South, and those others that served in the Multinational Division Southeast, were withdrawn by their respective countries. In the meantime, we had had a tremendous amount of Iranian infiltration in the country, and it was that Iranian infiltration, Quds Force presence, the presence of Shia and Sunni militants that this did not like being an occupied country, that saw us fighting a war through the 2011. And it is my humble belief that had we followed the plan, had we kept the Iraqi army in place, cleaned it up, reoriented it, rearmed it, and done the things that we were supposed to do in accordance with the plan, to include having a much larger force to occupy the country and clamp it down, it is my personal belief, and I suppose it's arguable, that we could have been out of Iraq, with the exception of a military support group of some size,
right,
by between 2005 and 2006. And a lot of young Americans would not have to have been killed or maimed as a result of the extended war that we had there.
Oh, wow. And my viewers, my listener, they're those privates. They're the sergeants. They're the guys that were in Fallujah, in An-Najaf, crossing the Tigris. All the phase lines that you and your commanders were creating on the maps, they were calling in phase line Alpha, Charlie, Zulu time, you know. And so those guys might be mad, but I think they're only mad maybe because of the end result versus the not battling next to their battle buddy. They're not mad because they went to combat and fought with their buddy and they had to stick together in the trenches. I think they're upset that they maybe were used when it could have been used less.
Or they could have been used better.
That's what I mean, yeah.
And better appreciated. You know, I'm going to tell you something, Rad, and again, not everyone would agree with me, but you know, as a young second lieutenant and as a young cadet, I so enjoyed the stories of my uncles and, of course, my father, who shared them with me because they knew of my interest in the Army, and in the Army in particular, and in the military in general. And I thought to myself, you know, someday I'm going to lead men into battle. And that's what I want to do. You know, I'm going to fight the enemies of the United States. And, you know, I will tell you that young officers in particular all seek to be blooded in combat. And, of course, I was no exception. As a matter of fact, I would dare say that I was the rule. But I was committed to combat very early in my career, primarily small unit actions in places like South America, which I would rather not expound upon. But, later in Panama and then, of course, what I saw in Somalia. As the young second lieutenant or the young sergeant grows up as a soldier, you know, he still feels a need to be tested and to be proven. But the enthusiasm for war as a rule, when you see what it's all about, or perhaps you hold somebody in your arms who didn't duck when he should have, brings a different perspective to one's life. And I will tell you that I think it's most unfortunate that our nation finds itself again on the cusp of more combat and more war that will undoubtedly cause the severe wounds and death of the cream of our youth. It bothers me. But I'm often asked, particularly by the people who have read my book of late, Roland, would you do it again? And I always smile as I say, you know, I think I'd be a heck of a lot smarter, but I'd do so in a heartbeat.
Yeah. And you have to make decisive decisions and move forward with what happens next. You know, there's not a crystal ball, and you can only, like the kings of England, I went and visited a castle, and his only sanity was sitting in a room for 8 hours praying to a god to talk to him about sending his entire troop into battle. I was in this room, and I'm like, this is the room where he decided hours upon end. He would stay in there for 4 or 5 hours just praying, like, tell me what to do. It's so wild how some things are created war-wise, you know? What was his internet connection back then?
Well, you know, a wise man once said that the brain is the most powerful, the mind is the most powerful weapon. Mm. You know, I never met a guy who didn't believe in God in combat. And I know you've heard that phrase before, but I've got to tell you, it's true. I'll tell you a funny story, Rad. And I had the distinct privilege and honor of commanding the 508th Airborne Infantry in Panama.
Airborne.
And thank you very much. And all the way. We used to support the United States Army Jungle School, which at that time was located at a place called Fort Sherman, the other side of Panama, the Atlantic side. And that entailed a company plus of my battalion and a part of the battalion staff to conduct a parachute jump into a place we called the Gatun Drop Zone, which was right next to Gatun Lake. And it was, you know, of course, it was Sunday. And like everybody who prepares for a parachute jump or every unit, you have to assemble at your packing point and your pre-deployment point very early in the morning for a mid-morning jump. And that pretty much eliminates the opportunity to go to church. So I always used to coordinate to have our very, very good Catholic chaplain come down after he would say Mass, to come down to the hangar where we were preparing to, preparing our equipment to board the C-130s and conduct our parachute jump. And it never ceased to amaze me, Rad, that you not only got the Catholic boys, but practically everybody, knowing that they were about to hurl themselves out of an airplane, and regardless of how many times they had done it, you know, hurling yourself out of an airplane is not exactly a natural act. It is a very unnatural act, and we do it because it's another way to get to the enemy, and it requires a great deal of training and confidence and orientation and courage, frankly, particularly for the kinds of things that combat soldiers have to do. And so I always found it interesting that everybody wanted to be a little bit closer to God on those Sunday mornings when we were going to jump into this god-awful drop zone where, you know, it wasn't exactly a cleared area, you know. And I had guys who actually got lost in the kunai grass, which was so darn high. And the chance of going into the trees was very, very good. But I always got a big kick out of church attendance on those days in the hangar. And it only reinforced my belief that when the rubber meets the road, everyone knows that Ranger 6 up there will look out for you if you believe. And I have always believed, and I'm here today to tell my story.
You know, that's very, very, very cool, very teamwork oriented. I would imagine, you know, even a guy that's like, you know, agnostic or atheist and doesn't want to, you know, deal with it, doesn't go to church normally, he's probably standing around still like, I could take some of this good positive juju that you guys are all trying to get going, and I can, why not have a piece of it, you know? I tell people, if he's real and I get to him, he or she, and God says, Rad, you're a good dude, I'm totally what you want from me. He's not, I tell you what, okay? So, and it's funny because I just learned that God was added into the Pledge of Allegiance in 1954. It was indivisible, one nation, indivisible. And then now it's one nation under God, indivisible. But what I like about it is it's not just like one God. It is God as like an overall definition. So we all know that something's bigger than us. We don't have a definitive anything. That's what's called faith. And so faith in something is the belief that helps put you forward with your front foot so that you do the best you can every day. I was raised very religious in a Mormon family, and my dad was raised Catholic, converted to be Mormon. And now I just have my own belief of all of that stuff that's combined and just being a good person, you know? And if you guys were all in the hangar saying a prayer, I would have no problem piling up next to you guys shoulder to shoulder and saying, what do I say here?
Well, there's one other thing about that story that I need to tell you, Rad. You would have loved piling up to that crowd, because shortly after the reverend, the priest was done, he always had a few extra very small bottles of wine that he had not consecrated. And he looked at me and he said, you know, Colonel, with your permission, how about I toss out this extra wine to the boys? Now, there was just not enough there to throw anybody off.
Yeah.
So I said, knock yourself out, Father. And so if there were any agnostics or, you know, atheists or whatever in the back of the crowd, I can assure you they all found a place in the crowd to get their little bottle.
Exactly. You see, it's just about being neighborly and, you know, loving each other, but being ready to, you know, destroy the enemy. And you mentioned boxing earlier, right? And what boxing does, to bring this full circle for you, is it builds you up to be violent, to be humble, so you don't have to use it. Because once you're using boxing, it's not just one punch, it's multiple punches and, you know, some bobs and some weaves. In fact, right before I got on the show with you, I just came from boxing.
Oh, well, that's fantastic. Well, Rad, as you well know, all young officers, you know, whether it's the Virginia Military Institute, the United States Military Academy, the Citadel, the traditional upbringing of a young officer calls for several courses of instruction that go above and beyond the classroom. They include swimming. The classically trained officer is expected to know how to swim, primarily because he is required not only to be able to fend for himself, but also to teach his soldiers. But above and beyond swimming, the first thing that the young cadet at VMI or West Point is introduced to is the boxing ring, because you want to develop the confidence, the courage, the ability, the forthrightness to hold your own and aggressively pursue your opponent there in the boxing ring, but later down the road in combat as required. So the fighting skills give way to the confidence and the courage, the footwork, the physical ability, all of which boils down to an officer in the future capable of doing what Douglas MacArthur talked about in a quotation that he is often attributed to him. And that is, on the fields of friendly strife are sown the seeds that on other fields and on other days are reaped the fruits of victory. I always viewed boxing in that light, much like I did the football that I played. Mm-hmm. And oh, by the way, Rad, at the Virginia Military Institute, you either defeated your opponent or you bled in the effort. If you didn't do one of those two things, you didn't pass, and you could look forward to taking the course again.
Oh, it's serious business. Boxing is serious business. It's tougher than MMA, and I'll say it right now on the show, because in MMA, they get to tap out. They're like, oh, I'm going to tap out. But in boxing, it's like, 1, 2, are you good? Walk to me. All right. You're effed up, bro, but you're still fighting, dude. You don't get to tap out, dude. You get knocked out, or you take a knee, or you get a towel thrown in, right? But that's like, don't ever throw the towel in. And obviously, you know, we just lost Carl Weathers, who played Apollo Creed, you know, and Predator Dylan and Predator with Arnold Schwarzenegger, and huge boxing icon.
Absolutely. I was very sad to see that. Of course, I'm a big Stallone fan. Between sure. Rambo and Rocky. I mean, who's not? Who's a man's man, you know?
But
Carl Weathers played large in all of those, Rocky 1 through 4. I was very, very sad to see that.
And a lead, you know, he was a lead in the film. You know, it wasn't just like a small role. It was, hey, Apollo, I want to fight Apollo. Apollo's the man. I mean, really, he was yoked. I mean, if that's the definition of a boxer, that body, I am still working on it. But I've lost 30 pounds since June of last year. I've gone about 200 times since I started boxing, and I can't stop. There's a switch.
You know, Rad, it's good that you say that, because you need to protect yourself. And I can just defer back to my book, In Strange Company. When I'm with the Peninsula Shield Force, you probably read where I used to spend the evenings when I would come off patrol in the western Kuwaiti desert, engaging on a number of different matters in politics, family, and social issues with my Arab comrades. And of course, they came from throughout the Gulf region, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Oman, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, just to name several of them. And they always used to ask me, you know, Colonel Tiso, why are you always doing pull-ups and running around the camp? And I said, well, my brothers, you know, you are, as officers, expected to lead from the front. We have to stay in shape. And on top of that, when you are in good physical condition, you are better prepared to deal with the stress of combat, which, as you know, can be deadly. It can provoke heart attacks and the like. And besides, you must be an example to your men and look good in your uniform. You cannot be fat and out of shape. But you know, Brad, I'm going to tell you a story here. None of that really communicated well with my Arab brothers. And knowing that, having been amongst my Arab friends since 1994, up until I was assigned to the Peninsula Shield Force in the spring of 2003, I looked at them and with a smile I said, and beside my brother, if you remain in good shape and good condition, you will not have to ask me to supply you with all these bottles of Viagra. They were constantly asking me, Roland, can you get some Viagra for us? The very next day, Rad, when I was out doing my calisthenics, all of a sudden I saw 50 or 60 guys running around the camp and doing something for their physical conditioning. And so that's when it struck me, or reinforced what I always knew. You have to understand your audience, and particularly when you're in strange company. You have to understand what to say, what to do in order to convince them to do something that they may not want to do, whether it's physical training or an attacking an objective of some kind. And I found a way with regard to physical training on that particular night. And they, until we stood the force down, they were out there running, joining me at my pull-up bar, and doing whatever else they could to kind of improve their performance, perhaps not in combat, but certainly in bed.
I love that. Oh, my God. That's great. You know,
they didn't come asking for Viagra, did they?
Well, interestingly enough, not after that night. But I've always had a lot of fun, and I have a great deal of respect. Yeah. For a number of the Arab officers with whom I served in the spring of 2003. And I discuss all of that and in some detail in Strange Company.
Well, you know what? Colonel Tiso, retired, Roland, sir, dude, I get to say those things. I love my gig. I do. And wear a tiger stripe at the same time. So it's like, you know, being around all these different people. And did you learn the language? Did you learn, you know, any Arabic to try to communicate with these guys and have that?
Well, interestingly enough, the short answer to that question is no. However, every officer or every soldier seconded to advisory duties picks up a few words here and there. You learn how to greet them. You know, how to say goodnight, say thank you, all of those things. However, as I point out in Strange Company, very early on, growing up in old New York, I was exposed to Spanish. I grew up in the old ethnic neighborhoods of New York, and of course, there was a Hispanic neighborhood, there was a Polish neighborhood, a German neighborhood, of course, the Italian neighborhood where my family was, the Black neighborhood. And we played football in all of these neighborhoods. And as I started to get more and more into football, you know, we didn't have the fancy machines back then that you kids have today in the gyms, particularly to train the inner legs. And I was a running back. And in order to find ways to do that, I used to run down to a place called Rye Beach. And during any given day, there were a number of people who happened to be from Puerto Rico who used to be on the beach there, and they used to play a game called three-sided handball, and I learned to play very well. And in the course of that sports activity, I picked up a lot of Spanish. Then in high school, I continued my study of Spanish, and when I was eventually found myself at the Virginia Military Institute, I was tested for a foreign language, and I tested very well in Spanish, and ended up studying Spanish for another 4 years. In the multinational division Central South, there were three brigades, the Ukrainian Brigade, Polish Brigade, and the Spanish Brigade. And in the Spanish Brigade were several Central American armies, El Salvador, Nicaragua, Honduras, and the Dominican Republic. And I had to advise each of the brigades. And I went on a number of patrols with the Spanish, as well as with the El Salvadoran paratroopers. I was very, very comfortable around the El Sals because they were paratroopers and special forces. And they were very, very fine soldiers, a number of whom, the officers that is, and the senior NCOs, were combat veterans of the guerrilla war that had been fought in their country in the 80s and early 90s. And so the fact that I was able to do as well as I did with the Spaniards and with the Central American commanders was a direct result, I think, of my ability to converse with them in their native language. Not only was it very much appreciated, but it helped me to be more convincing in what I thought they needed to do in order to better conduct combat operations. And I'm very, very proud of that.
I love that. And I also think that, like, our leadership needs to have a different language as well as English. I understand the English first push here in the U.S., but it's okay if they speak Mandarin and also some Spanish or maybe some German, because there's nothing like having, you know, a conversation with someone and not thinking they're talking behind your back.
Well, I absolutely concur with that. And, you know, Mandarin is considered one of the most difficult languages in the world to learn. For a young officer to be able to speak that very difficult and yet very, very necessary language as we look at the future and our engagement in the Pacific, I think the Army would be very, very wise, and all of the services, of course, to look at developing young speakers very early in their careers. You know, I once had a very fine officer who I mentioned in Strange Company. He's a superb gentleman who went on to become a senior naval officer who, as a Russian Jew, was he and his family were thrown out of Russia in the 1980s by Putin and or whoever at that time. And they came to our great country. And this fellow, and his name is Gary Tabak, learned to speak English. And to this day, of course, he came as a young teenager, and he learned, of course, to speak English, but of course he speaks fluent Russian. Mm-hmm. And Gary, who I call Yuri Gary.
Everybody needs a Yuri.
Yeah. With his fluent Russian, became the first naval officer to be a foreign specialist, a foreign country specialist. And he spent a great deal of time serving our country in places like Poland and in Russia. And he went on to become a Navy captain and was the senior officer in the Navy when he retired several years ago. And he continues to serve our country, working with the Ukrainian media in Ukraine as we speak. So here is a perfect example of a guy who could speak the language, loved his adopted country, and went on to serve it so well for nearly 30 years as a foreign area specialist.
Well, we've had Roland for about an hour of time. We heard wonderful stories from him and got some insight into Iraq and going in and him as a planner. Really want to thank the retired colonel for being on the show. Roland J. Tiso Jr. In Strange Company is the book, An American Soldier with Multinational Forces in the Middle East and Iraq. He also has a foreword. I want to give a shout out to General Retired Anthony C. Zinni, United States Marine Corps, who gives him a foreword. Go check out his book and check out the book club. That's softrep.com/book-club. And go check out our merch store. And this is Rad saying peace.
You've been listening to Soft Rep Radio.